62.
As a child, Ben Stodd had been a slim, blue-eyed boy with curly blonde hair. The girls had been sighing and giggling over him since he was 9 years old.
"That'll stop soon enough," Ben's father said.
"All the Stodds make handsome enough lads, but he'll be like the rest of us when he gets his growth, I reckon.
His hair'll darken to brown, and he'll go around squinting at everything, and he'll have all the luck of a fat pig in the king's slaughtering pen."
But neither of the first two predictions came true. Ben was the first Stodd male in several generations to remain as blonde at 17 as he had been at 7, and who could tell a brown hawk from an auger hawk at 400 yards.
Far from developing a nearsighted squint, his eyes were amazingly keen, and the girls still sighed and giggled over him as much now at 17 as they had when he was 9.
As for his luck, well, that was another matter. That most of the Stodd men had been unlucky, at least for the last 100 years or so, was beyond argument. Ben's family thought that Ben might be the one to redeem them from their genteel poverty.
After all, his hair hadn't darkened, and his eyes hadn't grown dim, so why should he not escape the curse of bad luck as well? And after all, Prince Peter was his friend, and Peter would someday be king. Then Peter was tried and convicted of his father's murder.
He was in the needle before any of the bewildered Stodd family could get their minds around what had happened.
Ben's father, Andrew, went to Thomas's coronation, and he came home with a bruise on his cheek, a bruise his wife thought it might be prudent not to speak of. "I'm sure Peter's innocent," Ben said that night at supper.
"I simply refuse to believe."
The next moment he was sprawling on the floor, his ear ringing. His father was towering over him, pea soup dripping from his mustache, his face so red it was almost purple. And Ben's baby sister, Emmeline, was crying in her high chair.
"Don't mention the murdering whelp's name again in this house," his father said.
"Andrew," his mother cried. "Andrew, he doesn't understand."
His father, normally the kindest of men, turned his head and stared at Ben's mother. "Be quiet, woman," he said. And something in his voice made her sit down again. Even Emmeline stopped crying.
"Father," Ben said quietly, "I can't even remember the last time you struck me. It's been 10 years, I think, maybe longer. And I don't think you ever struck me in anger until now. But it doesn't change my mind. I don't believe..."
Andrew Stodd raised one warning finger. "I told you not to mention his name," he said, "and I meant it, Ben. I love you, but if you say his name, you'll be leaving my house."
"I'll not say it," Ben replied, getting up. "But because I love you, Da, not because I'm scared of you."
"Leave off,"
Mrs. Stodd cried, more frightened than ever.
"I won't have the two of you bickering this way. Do you want to drive me insane?"
"No, Mother, don't worry. It's over," Ben said.
"Isn't it, Da?"
"It's over," his father said.
"You're a good son in all things, Ben, and always have been. But mention him not."
There were things Andy Stodd felt he couldn't tell his son. Although Ben was 17, Andy still saw him as a boy. He would have been surprised if he'd known that Ben understood his reasons for striking out quite well. Before the unfortunate turn of events, of which you now know, Ben's friendship with the prince had already begun changing things for the Stodds. Their inner barony's farm had once been very large. Over the last 100 years, they had been forced to sell the land off, a piece at a time. Now fewer than 60 reels remained, most of that mortgaged. But over the last 10 years or so, things had gradually improved. Bankers who had been threatening first became willing to extend the outstanding mortgages and to even offer new loans at interest rates so cheap they were unheard of. It had hurt Andrew Stodd bitterly to see the land of his ancestors whittled away reel by reel, and it had been a happy day for him when he was able to go to Halvey, the owner of the next farm over, and tell him that he had changed his mind about selling him the 3 reels Halvey had wanted to buy for the last 9 years. And he knew who he had to thank for these wonderful changes, too. His son. His son, who was a close friend of the prince, who also happened to be the king in waiting. Now they were only the unlucky Stodds again,
If that had been all, only a case of things going back to the way they had been, he could have stood up under it without striking his son at the dinner table, an act of which he was already ashamed. But things weren't going to go back to the way they had been. Their position had worsened. He had been lulled when the bankers had stopped behaving like sheep instead of wolves. He had borrowed a great deal of money, some to buy back land which he had already sold, some to install things like the new windmill. Now he felt sure the bankers would take off their sheepskins, and instead of losing the farm a piece at a time, he might lose it all at once. Nor was that all. Some instinct had told him to forbid any of his family members to go to Thomas's coronation, and he had listened to that inner voice. Tonight he was glad. It had happened after the coronation, and he supposed he should have expected it. He went into a mead house to have a drink before starting home. He was very depressed by the whole sorry business of the king's murder and Peter's imprisonment. He felt that he needed a drink. He had been recognized as Ben's father. "Did your son help his friend do the deed, Stodd?" one of the drunks had called, and there had been nasty laughter. "Did he hold the old man while the prince poured the burning pison down his throat?" one of the others called out in turn. Andrew had put his mug down, half empty. This was not a good place to be. He would leave, quickly. But before he could get out, a third drunk, a giant of a man who smelled like a pile of moldy cabbages, pulled him back. "And how much did you know?" this giant had asked in a low, rumbling voice. "Nothing," Andrew said. "I know nothing about this business, and neither does my son. Let me pass." "You'll pass when, and if, we decide to let you pass," the giant said, and shoved him backward into the waiting arms of the other drunks. The pummeling then began. Andy Stodd was pushed from one to the next, sometimes slapped, sometimes elbowed, sometimes tripped. No one quite dared to go as far as punching him, but they came close. He had seen in their eyes how badly they had wanted to. If the hour had been later and they had been drunker, he might have found himself in very serious trouble indeed. Andrew was not tall, but he was broad-shouldered and well-muscled. He calculated that he might be able to dust off any two of these idlers in a fair fight, with the exception of the giant, and he thought that perhaps he could give even that fellow a run for his money. One or two, possibly even three. But there were 8 or 10 there in all. If he had been Ben's age, full of pride and hot blood, he still might have had a go at them. But he was 45, and did not relish the thought of creeping home to his family, beaten within an inch of his life. It would hurt him and frighten them, and both things would be to no purpose. It was just the Stodd luck come home with a vengeance, and there was nothing to do but endure it. The barkeeper stood watching it all, doing nothing, not attempting to put a stop to it. At last they had let him escape. Now he feared for his wife, his daughter, and most of all for his son Ben, who would be the prime target for bullies such as those. "If it had been Ben in there instead of me," he thought, "they would have used their fists all right. They would have used their fists and beaten him unconscious, or worse." So, because he loved his son and was afraid for him, he had struck him and threatened to drive him from the house if Ben ever mentioned the prince by name again. People are funny sometimes. 63. What Ben Stodd didn't already understand abstractly about this strange new state of affairs, he discovered very concretely the next day. He had driven 6 cows to market and sold them for a good price to a stockman who didn't know him, or the price mightn't have been so good. He was walking toward the city gates when a bunch of loitering men set upon him, calling him murderer and accomplice, and names even less pleasant. Ben did well against them. They beat him quite badly in the end. There were 7 of them. But they paid for the privilege with bloody noses, black eyes, and lost teeth. Ben picked himself up and went home, arriving after dark. He ached all over, but he was, all things considered, rather pleased with himself. His father took one look at him and knew exactly what had happened. "Tell your mother you fell down," he said. "Ida,
Ben said, knowing his mother would not believe any such story. And after this, I'll take the cows to market, or the corn, or whatever we have to take to market, at least until the bankers come and take the place out from under us. No, Da, Ben said, just as calmly as he had said I. For a young man who had taken a bad beating, he was in a very strange mood indeed, almost cheerful, in fact. What do you mean, telling me no? His father asked, thunderstruck. If I run or hide, they'll come after me. If I stand my ground, they'll grow tired soon enough and look for easier sport. If someone draws a knife from his boot, Andrew said, voicing his greatest fear, you'll never live to see them grow tired of it, Benny. Ben put his arms around his father and hugged him tight. A man can't outsmart the gods, Ben said, quoting one of Delane's oldest proverbs. You know that, Da. And I'll fight for him you'd not have me mention? His father looked at him sadly and said, you'll never believe it of him, will you? No, Ben said steadfastly. Never. I think you've become a man while I wasn't looking, his father said. It's a sad way to have to become a man, scuffling in the streets of the market with gutter louts. And these are sad times that have come to Delane. Yes, Ben said. They are sad times. God's help you, Andrew said. And God's help this unlucky family. 64. Thomas had been crowned near the end of a long, bitter winter. On the 15th day of his reign, the last of that season's great storms fell on Delane. Snow fell fast and thick, and long after dark the wind continued to scream, building drifts like sand dunes. At 9 o'clock on that bitter night, long after anyone sensible should have been out, there was a fist began to fall on the front door of the Stodd house. It was not light or timid, that fist. It hammered rapidly and heavily on the stout oak. Answer me and be quick, it said. I haven't all night. Andrew and Ben sat before the fire reading. Susan Stodd, wife of Andrew and mother of Ben, sat between them, working at a sampler which would read, God's Bless Our King, when finished. Emmeline had long since been put to bed. The three of them looked up at the knock, then around at each other. There was only curiosity in Ben's eyes, but both Andrew and Susan were instantly, instinctively afraid. Andrew rose, putting his reading glasses in his pocket. Da? Ben asked. I'll go, Andrew said. Let it only be some traveler, lost in the dark and seeking shelter, he hoped. But when he opened the door, a soldier of the king stood there on the stoop, stolid and broad-shouldered. A leather helmet, the helmet of a fighting man, clung to his head. There was a short sword in his belt, near to hand. Your son, he said, and Andrew felt his knees buckle. Why do you want him? I come from Pena, the soldier said, and Andrew understood that this was all the answer he was to have. Da? Ben asked from behind. No, Andrew thought miserably. Please, this is too much bad luck. Not my son, not my son. Is that the boy? Before Andrew could say no, useless as that would have been, Ben had stepped forward. I am Ben Stodd, he said. What do you want with me? You must come with me, the soldier said. Where? To the house of Anders Pena. No, his mother cried from the doorway of their small living room. No, it's late. It's cold. The roads are full of snow. I have a sleigh, the soldier said inexorably, and Andrew Stodd saw the man's hand drop to the shaft of his short sword. I'll come, Ben said, getting his coat. Ben, Andrew began, thinking, we'll never see him again. He's to be taken away from us because he knew the prince. It will be all right, Da, Ben said, and hugged him. And when Andrew felt that young strength embracing him, he could almost believe it. But he thought his son had not learned fear yet. He had not learned how cruel the world could be. Andrew Stodd held his wife. The two of them stood in the doorway and watched Ben and the soldier break their way through the drifts toward the sleigh, which was only a shadow in the dark with lanterns glowing eerily on either side. Neither of them spoke as Ben climbed up on one side, the soldier on the other. Only one soldier, Andrew thought. That's something. Maybe it's only for questioning that they want him. Pray it's only for questioning that they want my son. The Stod stood in silence, membranes of snow blowing around their ankles, as the sleigh pulled away from the house, the flames and the lanterns jiggling, the sleigh bells jingling. When they were gone, Susan burst into tears.
We'll never see him again, she sobbed. Never, never. They've taken him. Damn Peter. Damn him for what he's brought my son to. Damn him, damn him.
Shh, Mother, Andrew said, holding her tightly. Shh, shh. We'll see him before morning. By noon at the latest. But she heard the quiver in his voice and cried all the harder. She cried so hard she woke little Emmeline up, or maybe it was the draft from the open door, and it was a very long time before Emmeline would go back to sleep. At last Susan slept with her, the two of them in the big bed. Andy Stodd did not sleep at all that night. He sat up by the fire, hoping against hope, but in his heart he believed he would never see his son again. 65. Ben Stodd stood in Andrew's painter's study an hour later. He was curious, even a little awed, but not afraid. He had listened closely to everything Painter said, and there had been a muted chink as money changed hands. "You understand all of this, lad?" Painter asked in his dry courtroom voice. "Yes, my lord." "I would be sure. This is no child's business I send you on. Tell me again what you are to do." "I am to go to the castle and speak to Dennis, son of Brandon." "And if Brandon interferes?" Pina asked sharply. "I am to tell him he must speak to you." "Aye," Pina said, settling back in his chair. "I am not to say, tell no one of this arrangement." "Yes," Pina said. "Do you know why?" Ben stood thoughtfully for a moment, head down. Pina let him think. He liked this boy. He seemed cool-headed and unafraid. Many others brought before him in the middle of the night would have been gibbering with terror. "Because if I said such a thing, he would be quicker to tell than if I said nothing," Ben said finally. A smile touched Faina's lips. "Good," he said. "Go on." "You've given me 10 guilders. I'm to give 2 to Dennis, one for himself and one for whoever finds the dollhouse that belonged to Peter's mother. The other 8 are for Beeson, the chief warder. Whoever finds the dollhouse will deliver it to Dennis. Dennis will deliver it to me. I will deliver it to Beeson. As for the napkins, Dennis himself will take them to Beeson." "How many?"
21 each week," Ben replied promptly. "Napkins of the royal house, but with the crest removed. Your man will engage a woman to remove the royal crests. From time to time you will send someone to me with more money, either for Dennis or for Beeson."
"But none for yourself?" Pina asked. He had already offered. Ben had refused.
"No, I believe that's everything."
"You are quick."
"I only wish I could do more."
Pena sat up, his face suddenly harsh and forbidding. "You must not, and you shall not," he said. "This is dangerous enough. You are procuring favors for a young man who has been convicted of committing a foul murder, the second foulest murder a man may do."
"Peter is my friend," Ben said, and he spoke with a dignity that was impressive in its simplicity.
Anders Pena smiled faintly and raised one finger to point at the fading bruises on Ben's face. "I would guess," he said, "that you are already paying for that friendship."
"I would pay such a price 100 times over, Ben said.
He hesitated just a moment and then went on boldly.
"I don't believe he killed his father. He loved King Roland as much as I love my own Da."
"Did he?"
Pena asked, apparently without interest. "He did," Ben cried. "Do you believe he murdered his father? Do you really believe he did it?"
Cana smiled, such a dry and ferocious smile then, that even Ben's hot blood was cooled. "If I didn't, I should be careful who I said it to," he said. "Very, very careful. Or I should soon feel the headsman's blade go through my neck." Ben stared at Pena silently. "You say you are his friend, and I believe you." Pena sat up straighter in his chair and leveled a finger at Ben. "If you would be a true friend, do just the things I have asked and no more. If you see any hope for Peter's eventual release in your mysterious summons here, and I see by your face that you do, you must give that hope up." Rather than ring for Arlen, Pena saw the boy out himself, out the back way. The soldier who had brought him tonight would be on his way to the Western Barony tomorrow. At the door, Pena said, "Once more, do not stray from the things we've agreed upon, so much as one solitary bit. The friends of Peter are not much cared for in Delane now, as your bruises prove."
"I'd fight them all," Ben said hotly. "One at a time, or all at once."
"Aye," Anders Pena said, with that dry, ferocious smile. "And would you ask your mother to do the same? Or your baby sister?" Ben gaped at the old man. Fear opened in his heart like a small and delicate rose. "It will come to that, if you do not exercise all your care," Pena said. "The storms are not over in Delane yet, but only beginning." He opened the door. Snow swirled in, driven by a black gust of wind. "Go home now, Ben. I think your parents will be happy to see you so soon." This was an understatement of some size. Ben's parents were waiting at the door in their night clothes when Ben let himself in. They had heard the jingle of the approaching sleigh. His mother hugged him close, weeping. His father, red-faced, unaccustomed tears standing in his eyes, wrung Ben's hand until it ached. Ben remembered Pena saying, "The storms are not over, but only beginning." And still later, lying in bed with his hands behind his head, staring up into the darkness and listening to the wind whistle outside, Ben realized that Pena had never answered his question, had never said whether or not he believed Peter to be guilty. 66. On the 17th day of Thomas's reign, Brandon's son, Dennis, brought the first lot of 21 napkins to the Needle. He brought them from a storeroom that neither Peter nor Thomas nor Ben Stodd nor Pena himself knew about, although all would become aware of it before the grim business of Peter's imprisonment was done. Dennis knew because he was a butler's son from a long line of butlers. But familiarity breeds contempt, so they say, and he thought nothing much about the storeroom from which he fetched the napkins. We'll speak more of this room later. Let me tell you now only that all would have been struck with wonder at the sight of it, and Peter in particular. For had he known of this room, which Dennis took completely for granted, he might have attempted his escape as much as 3 years sooner. And much, for better or for worse, might have been changed. 67. The royal crest was removed from each napkin by a woman Pena had hired for the quickness of her needle and the tightness of her lips. Each day she sat in a rocker just outside the doorway of the storeroom, picking out stitches that were very old indeed. When she did this, her lips were tight, for more reasons than one. To unmake such lovely needlework seemed to her almost a desecration. But her family was poor, and the money from Pena was like a gift from heaven. So there she sat, and would sit for years to come, rocking and plying her needle like one of those weird sisters, of whom you may have heard in another tale. She spoke to no one, not even her husband, about her days of unmaking. The napkins had a strange, faint smell, not of mildew, but of must, as if from long disuse. But they were otherwise without fault, each of them 20 rondels by 20, big enough to cover the lap of even the most dedicated eater. There was a bit of comedy attached to the first napkin delivery. Dennis hung about Beeson, expecting a tip. Beeson let him hang about a while, because he expected that sooner or later the dim-witted lad would remember to tip him. They both came to the conclusion that neither was going to be tipped at the same time. Dennis started for the door, and Beeson helped him along with a kick in the seat of the pants. This caused a pair of lesser warders to laugh heartily. Then Beeson pretended to wipe his bottom with the handful of napkins for the lesser warder's further amusement, but he was careful only to pretend. After all, Pena was in this business somewhere, and it was best to tread lightly. Perhaps Pena would not be around a great deal longer, however. In the mead houses and wine shops, Beeson had begun to hear whispers that Flagg's shadow had fallen on the Judge General, and that if Pena was not very, very careful, he might soon be watching the proceedings at court from an even more commanding angle than the bench upon which he now sat. He might be looking in the window, these wags said behind their hands, from one of the spikes atop the castle walls. 68. On the 18th day of Thomas's reign, the first napkin was on Peter's breakfast tray when it was delivered in the morning. It was so large, and the breakfast so small, that it actually covered the meal completely. Peter smiled for the first time since he had come to this cold, high place. His cheeks and chin were shadowed with the beginnings of a beard, which would grow full and long in these two drafty rooms, and he looked quite a desperate character, until he smiled. The smile lit his face with magical power, made it strong and radiant, a beacon to which one could imagine soldiers rallying in battle. Ben, he muttered, picking the napkin up by one corner. His hand shook a bit. I knew you'd do it. Thank you, my friend. Thank you. The first thing Peter did with his first napkin was to wipe away the tears that now ran freely down his cheeks. The peephole and the stout wooden door popped open. Two lesser warders appeared again, like the two heads of Flagg's parrot, packed into the tiny space, cheek to scruffy cheek. "Hope that baby won't forget to wipe his chinny chin," one cried in a cracked, warbling voice. "Hope that baby won't forget to wipe the eggy off his shirty," the other cried, and then both screamed with derisive laughter. But Peter did not look at them, and his smile did not fade. The warders saw that smile and made no more jokes. There was something about it which forbade joking. Eventually they closed the peephole and left Peter alone. A napkin came with his lunch that day, with his dinner that night. The napkins came to Peter in his lonely cell in the sky for the next 5 years. 69. The dollhouse arrived on the 30th day of Thomas the Lightbringer's reign. By then, models, those first harbingers of spring, which we call bluets, were coming up in pretty little roadside bunches. Also by then, Thomas the Lightbringer had signed into law the farmer's tax increase, which quickly became known as Tom's Black Tax. The new joke told in the mead houses and wine shops was that the king would soon be changing his royal name to Thomas the Taxbringer. The increase was not 8%, which might have been fair, or 18%, which might have been bearable, but 80%. Thomas had had some doubts about it at first, but it hadn't taken Flagg long to convince him. "We must tax them more on what they admit they own, so we can collect at least some of what's due us on all they hide from the tax collector," Flagg said. Thomas, his head fuddled by the wine that now flowed constantly in the court chambers of the castle, had nodded with what he hoped was a wise expression on his face. For his part, Peter had begun to fear that the dollhouse had been lost after all these years, and that was almost the truth. Ben Stodd had commissioned Dennis to find it. After several days of fruitless searching, Dennis had confided in his good old Da, the only person he dared trust with such a serious matter. It had taken Brandon another 5 days to find the dollhouse in one of the minor storage rooms on the 9th floor, west turret, where its cheerful pretend lawns and long rambling wings were hidden under an ancient and slightly moth-eaten dust cloth that was gray with the years. All of the original furnishings were still in the house, and it had taken Brandon and Dennis and a soldier, hand-picked by Pena, 3 more days to make sure all the sharp things were removed. Then, at last, The dollhouse was delivered by two squire boys who toiled up the 300 stairs with the heavy, awkward thing spiked to a board between them. Beeson followed closely behind, cursing and threatening terrible reprisals if they should drop it. Sweat rolled down the boys' faces in rivers, but they made no reply. When the door of Peter's prison opened and the dollhouse was brought in, Peter gasped with surprise, not just because the dollhouse was finally here, but because one of the two boys carrying it was Ben Stodd. "Give not a sign," Ben's eyes flashed. "Don't look at me too long," Peters flashed back. After the advice he had given, Pena would have been stunned to see Ben here. He had forgotten that the logic of all the wise old men in the world cannot often stand against the logic of a boy's heart, if the boy's heart is large and kind and loyal. Ben Stodd's was all three. It had been the easiest thing in the world to exchange places with one of the squires meant to carry the dollhouse to the top of the needle. For a guilder, all the money Ben had in the world, as a matter of fact, Dennis had arranged it. "Don't tell your father of this," Ben cautioned Dennis. "Why not?" Dennis had asked. "I tell my old Da almost everything, don't you?" "I did," Ben said, remembering how his father had forbidden him to mention Peter's name anymore in the house. "But when boys grow up, I think that sometimes changes. However that may be, you mustn't tell him this, Dennis. He might tell Pena, and then I'd be in a hot pot on a high fire." "All right," Dennis promised. It was a promise he kept. Dennis had been cruelly hurt when his master, whom he had loved, had been first accused and then convicted of murder. In the last few days, Ben had gone a long way toward filling the empty place in Dennis's heart. "That's good," Ben said, and punched Dennis playfully on the shoulder. "I only want to see him a minute and refresh my heart. He was your best friend, wasn't he?" "Still is." Dennis had stared at him amazed. "How can you claim a man who murdered his own father as your best friend?" "Because I don't believe he did it," Ben said. "Do you?" To Ben's utter amazement, Dennis burst into wretched tears. "All my heart says the same, and yet..." "Listen to it, then," Ben said, and gave Dennis a large, rough hug. "And dry off your mug before someone sees you bawling like a kid." "Put it in the other room," Peter said now, distressed at the slight tremble in his voice. Beeson didn't notice. He was too busy cursing the two boys for their slowness, their stupidity, their very existence. They carried the dollhouse into the bedroom and set it down. The other boy, who had a very stupid face, dropped his end too quickly and too hard. There was the tiny sound of something breaking inside. Peter winced. Beeson cuffed the boy, but he smiled as he did it. It was the first good thing that had happened to him since these two lads had appeared with the accursed thing. The stupid boy stood up, wiping the side of his face, which was already starting to swell, and staring at Peter with frank wonder and fear, his mouth wide open. Ben remained on his knees a moment longer. There was a small rattan mat in front of the house's front door, what we would call a welcome mat, I suppose. For just a moment, Ben allowed his thumb to move over the top of this, and his eyes met Peter's. "Now get out," Beeson cried. "Get out, both of you. Go home and curse your mothers for ever bringing such slow, clumsy fools as yourselves into the world." The boys passed Peter, the loutish one shrinking away as if the prince might have a disease he could catch. Ben's eyes met Peter's once more, and Peter trembled at the love he saw in his old friend's gaze. Then they were gone. "Well, you have it now, my good little princeling," Beeson said. "What shall we be bringing you next? Little ruffly dresses? Silk underpants?" Peter turned slowly and looked at Beeson. After a moment, Beeson dropped his eyes. There was something frightening in Peter's gaze, and Beeson was forced to remember again that, sissy or not, Peter had beaten him so badly that his ribs had ached for 2 days, and he had had dizzy spells for a week. "Well, it's your business," he muttered. "But now that you have it, I could find a table for you to put it on. And a chair to sit in while you... He grimaced. While you play with it. And how much would this cost? A mere 3 guilders, I should think. I have no money. Ah, but you know powerful people. No more, Peter said. I traded a favor for a favor, that's all. Sit on the floor, then, and get chilblains on your arse, and be damned to you, Beeson said, and strode from the room. The little flood of guilders he had enjoyed since Peter came to the needle had apparently dried up. It put Beeson in a foul mood for days. Peter waited until he had heard all the locks and bolts go rattling home before lifting the rattan mat Ben had rubbed with his thumb. Beneath, he found a square of paper no larger than the stamp on a letter. Both sides had been written on, and there were no spaces between the words. The letters were tiny indeed. Peter had to squint to read them, and guessed that Ben must have made them with the aid of a magnifying glass. Peter, destroy this after you have read it. I don't believe you did it. Others feel the same, I am sure. I am still your friend. I love you as I always did. Dennis does not believe it either. If I can ever help, get to me through Pena. Let your heart be steadfast. As he read this, Peter's eyes filled with warm tears of gratitude. I think that real friendship always makes us feel such sweet gratitude, because the world almost always seems like a very hard desert, and the flowers that grow there seem to grow against such high odds. Good old Ben, he whispered over and over again. In the fullness of his heart, he couldn't think to say anything else. Good old Ben. Good old Ben. For the first time, he began to think that his plan, wild and dangerous as it was, might have a chance of succeeding. Next, he thought of the note. Ben had put his life on the line to write it. Ben was noble, barely, but not royal, thus not immune from the headsman's axe. If Beeson or one of his jackals found this note, they would guess that one or the other of the boys who had brought the dollhouse must have written it. The loutish one looked as if he couldn't read even the large letters in a child's book, let alone write such tiny ones as these. So they would look for the other boy, and from there to the chopping block might be a short trip for good old Ben. He could think of only one sure way to get rid of it, and he didn't hesitate. He crumpled the little note up between the thumb and forefinger of his right hand and ate it. 70. By now I am sure you have guessed Peter's plan of escape, because you know a good deal more than Pena did when he read Peter's requests. But in any case, the time has come to tell you straight out. He planned to use linen threads to make a rope. The threads would come, of course, from the edges of the napkins. He would descend this rope to the ground and so escape. Some of you may be laughing very hard at this idea. Threads from napkins to escape a tower 300 feet high? You could be saying. Either you are mad, storyteller, or Peter was. Nothing of the sort. Peter knew how high the needle was, and he believed he must never be greedy about how many threads he took from each napkin. If he unraveled too much, someone might become very curious. It didn't have to be the chief warder. The laundress who washed the napkins might be the one to notice whether a lot of each one was gone. She might mention it to a friend, who could mention it to another friend, and so the story would spread. And it wasn't really Beeson Peter was worried about, you know. Beeson was, all things said, a fairly stupid fellow. Flagg was not. Flagg had murdered his father, and Flagg kept his ear to the ground. It was a shame Peter never stopped to wonder about that vague smell of must about the napkins, or to ask if the person hired to remove the royal crests had been let go after removing a certain number, or if that person was still at work. But, of course, his mind was on other things. He could not help noticing that they were very old, and this was certainly a good thing. He was able to take a great many more threads from each than he would ever have guessed in even his most optimistic moments. How many more than that he could have taken, he came to know only in time. Still,
I can hear some of you saying. Threads from napkins to make a rope long enough to reach from the window of the needle's topmost cell to the courtyard? Threads from napkins to make a rope strong enough to support 170 pounds? I still think you are joking. Those of you who think so are forgetting the dollhouse and the loom within. A loom so tiny that the threads of napkins were perfect for its tiny shuttle. Those of you who think so are forgetting that everything in the dollhouse was tiny, but worked perfectly. The sharp things had been removed, and that included the loom's cutting blade, but otherwise it was intact. It was the dollhouse about which Flagg had had vague misgivings so long ago, which was now Peter's only real hope of escape. 71. I would have to be a much better storyteller than I am, I think, to tell you how it was for Peter during the 5 years he spent at the top of the needle. He ate, he slept, he looked out the window, which gave him a view to the west of the city. He exercised morning, noon, and evening. He dreamed his dreams of freedom. In the summer, his apartment sweltered. In the winter, it froze. During the second winter, he caught a bad case of the grip, which almost killed him. Peter lay feverish and coughing under the thin blanket on his bed. At first, he was only afraid he would lapse into delirium and rave about the rope that was hidden in a neat coil under two of the stone blocks on the east side of his bedroom. As his fever grew worse, the rope he had woven with the tiny dollhouse loom came to seem less important because he began to think he would die. Beeson and his lesser warders were convinced of it. They had, in fact, begun to wager on when it would happen. One night, about a week after the onset of his fever, while the wind raged blackly outside and the temperature dropped down to zero, Roland appeared to Peter in a dream. Peter was convinced that Roland had come to take him to the far fields. "I'm ready, Da," he cried. In his delirium, he didn't know if he had spoken aloud or only in his mind. "I'm ready to go." "You'll not be dying yet," his father said in this dream, or vision, or whatever it was. "You've much to do, Peter." "Father," Peter shrieked. His voice was powerful, and below him the warders, Beeson included, quailed, thinking that Peter must be seeing the smoking, murdered ghost of King Roland come to take Peter's soul to hell. They made no more wagers that night, and in fact one of them went to the Church of the Great Gods the very next day and embraced his religion again, and eventually became a priest. This man's name was Curran, and I may tell you of him in another story. Peter really was seeing a ghost in a way, although whether it was the actual shade of his father or only a ghost born in his fever-struck brain, I cannot say. His voice lapsed into a mutter. The warders did not hear the rest. "It's so cold, and I am so hot." "My poor boy," his glimmering father said. "You've had hard trials, and there are more of them ahead, I think. But Dennis will know." "Know what?" Peter gasped. His cheeks were red, but his forehead was as pale as a wax candle. "Dennis will know where the sleepwalker goes," his father whispered, and was gone. Peter lapsed into a faint that quickly became a deep, sound sleep. In that sleep, his fever broke. The boy who had made it his practice over the last year to do 60 push-ups and 100 sit-ups each day awoke the next morning too weak to even get out of bed, but he was lucid again. Beeson and the lesser warders were disappointed, but after that night they always treated Peter with a kind of awe and took care never to go too close to him, which of course made his job that much easier. All that is an easy enough tale to tell, though it would no doubt be better if I could say for sure that the ghost was there or that it was not. But like other matters in the larger tale, you'll have to make up your own mind about it, I suppose. But how am I to tell you about Peter's endless drudging work at that tiny loom? That tale is beyond me. All the hours spent, sometimes with frosty breath pluming from his mouth and nose, sometimes with sweat running down his face,
always in fear of discovery. All those long hours alone, with nothing but long thoughts and almost absurd hopes to fill them. I can tell you some things, and will, but to convey such hours and days of slow time is impossible for me, and might be impossible for anyone, except one of the great storytellers whose race is long vanished. Perhaps the only thing that even vaguely suggests how much time Peter spent in those two rooms was his beard. When he came in, it was only a shadow on his cheeks and a smudge under his nose, a boy's beard. In the 1,825 days which followed, it grew long and luxuriant. By the end, it reached the middle of his chest, and although he was only 21, it was shot with gray. The only place it did not grow was along the length of the jagged scar left by Beeson's thumbnail. Peter dared pluck only 5 threads from each napkin the first year, 15 threads